Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Levy, and I'm here representing Johnny Marquez along with my co-counsel, Matthew Hall. As indicated and as set forth in our briefs, our position here is pretty clear. We think that the jury quite obviously did not understand the instructions, did not follow the instructions, and as a result of that, we should be entitled to a new trial. The primary authority that we are relying upon is the Larson case, and that's Larson versus ATSI, and it's very clear, it's very unequivocal. Quote, in light of the defendant's admission of the existence of the physical injury, the jury's verdict for defendants cannot be supported by the evidence, close quote. And that's the situation we have here. The opposition to this is the Lee's Mobile Car Wash case, which we think is much different because primarily it was a FIP case. They started off with medical bills under no fault for up to $50,000, and it does not change the rule in Larson. Here we have not only an admission, we have an actual stipulation. The stipulation came first in the trial management order, and the trial management order very clearly says that the parties stipulate that Mr. Marquez sustained some injury as a result of the automobile accident, a fact that in fact was accepted by American Family Insurance throughout their claim handling process. They agreed to it. They agreed that there were a certain number of medical bills incurred.
Mr. Levy, yes, how does that statement in the trial management order that Mr. Marquez incurred some injury square with his recovery for the underinsured motorist claim of $100,000?
Well, it's clear he sustained some injury, and he collected $100,000 from the negligent motorist. He then had another couple of $100,000 available to him under his underinsured motorist coverage.
Right, but so, how do we know that the whatever injuries he sustained were not covered by the $100,000 he received under the UIM settlement?
Well, what we do know is that the jury was instructed. In addition to the statement in the trial management order, there was a direct instruction to the jury that the parties have stipulated that he sustained some injury. And then the verdict form that the jury ultimately filled out said what were his damages as a result of being involved in the accident, and they said zero. So they just can't both be true. If we have a stipulation that there's injury, and then we have the statement by the jury saying that there was no injury.
And they also had an interrogatory response indicating that the damages incurred were not in excess of $100,000, correct?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Levy,
yes, sir.
Under the rules relating to inconsistent verdicts, aren't we required to look to see if there's any way we can reconcile what may be an error by the jury in one respect with another finding of the jury, which I think could be read to say that, no, the damages didn't exceed $100,000. Don't we have to try and reconcile those two things?
I understand the principle, Your Honor, and yes, but in this case where the jury is explicitly told that there is this stipulation and that they incurred damages and the jury said, no, he didn't incur damages, that is an inconsistent verdict that I guess our position is in fact irreconcilable. And then again, in the motion for a new trial that we filed, with all due respect to the trial court, they applied the wrong standard, say that there was no evidence of damages as a result of the conduct of American Family. And then we have here, again, sort of a unique situation here because it's an insurance company. We're not just talking about a tortfeasor here. And a lot of the opposition brief is connected to, well, there was no sort of real binding admission. And I would like to point out to the court a couple of places where there was, in fact, exactly that. But we have an insurance company, and the other thing I want to tell this panel is I think there are very few places where supplemental authority has been sort of so relevant as comes into play here, and that I'm referring to the Fisher case that we submitted as supplemental authority, which is new law, clarified a lot of Colorado law, but it talks about the fact that insurance companies are not allowed to just sit back and wait for a decision-making process. And so, for example, with the admissions that American Family made here, and I'm referring here to the transcript, page 685, and the following is a quote. "Now, at this point, ma'am, we know that Mr. Marquez was injured in an automobile accident. It was caused by an underinsured motorist, and American Family had determined that he was legally entitled to compensatory damages. Somewhere between the range of $121,794 and $131,794, right?" Answer, correct. And that then is an admission by American Family, not just that it was some sort of what the opposition brief says is, well, that was just sort of a settlement amount. That was not. That was an admission by American Family that they determined in this breach of contract case, because this is not a case to determine the value of the claim. This was a breach of contract claim that we were making. We tendered an instruction on breach of contract that would allow the jury to have given an award of damages for breach of contract, that the defendant in this case admitted that he was legally entitled to compensatory damages, which is the contract language, in excess of the $100,000. Similarly, they admitted and acknowledged that all the cervical issues are related to the accident. That's the record, the transcript at page 680. And they recognized that he had lost wages.
You mentioned the Fisher case. What does that have to do with this case?
Well, the Fisher case rejected the idea that an insurance company can wait before there's before an agreement before they have to pay anything. Here we have American Family admitting that Mr. Marquez was legally entitled to collect from the underinsured motorist something in excess of the $100,000 and yet paid nothing. And the reason they paid nothing, according to the testimony, and again, this came to the, you know, as a result of the new case. If you take a look at the transcript at page 705, 706, and then even more importantly, at page 846, where we had the claims people on the witness stand and they testified, so why didn't you pay him anything? And she said, well, because we have to first come to an agreement. And then once we come to an agreement, in addition to that, we're going to require the policyholder to sign a release agreement that is then going to require the policyholder, before we agree to pay anything, even though we have acknowledged we owed it. The Fisher case, I think the pertinent fact was the claims person said that we acknowledged that there were medical bills that were reasonable and necessary caused by the accident. We have the same thing here because American Family, first of all, paid most of the med pay, didn't pay the $502. And this is going to, I'm going to incorporate that into my position here, that if you take a look at the proceedings as a whole, Mr. Marquez did not get a fair trial, particularly since what we now know about the Colorado law from the Fisher case.
Can I ask you about the $502 for
yes,
a moment?
Sir.
I mean, let's assume that we were to agree with you that your client was entitled to a judgment for the $502. Assume that for the moment.
Yes, sir.
Isn't there still sufficient evidence in the record to support the jury's determination that there was no statutory or common law bad faith with respect to the payment of the $502?
Well, I suppose the court could view it that way. And what I would say, Your Honor, is that if we look at it in terms of the rules announced in the Fisher case, no. Because what was presented there is that we don't have to pay anything. We can unreasonably delay, or we can delay payment of anything until we get an agreement premised upon you agreeing to sign away all of your rights for bad faith or unreasonable delay or denial, which is a position that American Family has institutionally, which we think is unreasonable in and of itself. But that was part of what their expert said was perfectly reasonable for them to wait and not have to do any kind of piecemeal payment, even though they have acknowledged, the quote I just read to the court, that he was legally entitled to compensatory damages between point A and point B. So I think if you take into account the supplemental authority of not just the Fisher case, but also the Soischer case, I mean, the opposition cited the Soischer case as supplemental authority here, and what we have here is that at another point in the proceeding, the court allowed the defendants to argue that Mr. Marquez was non-cooperative and had not cooperated under the cooperation clause of his policy.
But do you agree with your opponent that American Family did pay out in a relatively timely manner all of the $5,000 of medical payment coverage initially?
Yes, sir.
And what happened was some provider didn't accept the $502, and that essentially came back to American Family? I mean, is that, just want to make sure I got the facts right. Is that what happened?
Okay. Yes, sir. And in that context, there's a whole lot of discussion in the briefing with respect to that was not pled by us as a breach of contract, and I disagree with that because we have sort of general notice pleadings and we pled all that. But that was, in fact, concealed from us. American Family didn't write a letter and said, we got this $502 back, what would you like us to do with it? American Family kept it, put it in the bank, and made no disclosure that they had received this money back.
Mr. Levy, when American Family paid the $5,000to Mr. Marcus, did it communicate a breakdown of how that $5,000 was itemized?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that yes, there were things like EOBs, explanation of benefits, that were sent along with the various payments to the providers. Again, there's a statutory scheme there about who gets to get paid first. So they paid it out, and then they got this refund.
But if there was an itemization of the $5,000, wouldn't you or Mr. Marquez or both of you have been able to determine that some of that had already been paid by, apparently, by your office?
No, sir. Because they originally paid the $5,000 and exhausted the $5,000 and sent a letter saying we've exhausted the $5,000. So, fine. The $502 came back, again, without any disclosure to anyone outside of American Family, something we didn't discover until after litigation, until we got their claim notes, that sort of thing. And with that, I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. You have 3 minutes and 25 seconds left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deborah Sutton and Jacqueline Booker here for American Family. The long and the short of this case is that the plaintiff was in a minor car accident with an 84-year-old woman. He hit her with the front end of his car after trying to stop. His airbag didn't even deploy. He had, at most, some sort of a minor complaint of neck and back pain for which he went to the emergency room. American Family offered to settle his underinsured motorist claim with him rather than litigate the case. He rejected that settlement and now is sorry that he did. In this case, the plaintiff first asks for a new trial on damages. And as we know, where the evidence is challenged as requiring a new trial, the court must look at the evidence in the light most favorably to the prevailing party, which was American Family in this case. Here, there was evidence to support this verdict. There was ample evidence. The verdict was not manifestly arbitrary.
What do you do with the fact?
I'm sorry.
Excuse me. What do you do with the fact that there was a stipulation as to the injury?
I was just about to get to that. In the trial management order, it said that the plaintiff sustained some injury. It didn't say he had a herniated disc. It didn't say that he sustained or incurred a specific amount of damages. It said he had some injury. And that, in our view, is totally different than stipulating to an amount of damages or saying that he had damages. And
but the jury said it was zero. Isn't that the problem? There are some damages. Forget about whether they stipulated to a specific amount. The jury was asked, as I read the instruction on the verdict form, to tell the court what was the total amount of damages, and they said zero. Isn't that a problem?
No, because injuries are one thing, damages are another. The jury could have determined, as we believe the evidence really supported, was that whatever occurred in this accident was de minimis. That, in keeping with the holding in the courts and the opinion of Lee's Mobile Wash versus Campbell, which we cited in our brief, The Supreme Court determined in that case that a jury may refuse to award damages where they are de minimis, for instance. And the court would only overturn such a verdict like that upon a showing of arbitrary and capriciousness or prejudice on the part of the jury, and only if the verdict is contrary to the weight of the evidence. And here, the plaintiff's testimony, the transcript of the plaintiff, he said, oh, well, I had, you know, typical car accident injuries. My neck jerked. His credibility was called into question time and time again.
Ms. Sutton, if the accident led to injuries that were so de minimis, as you suggest, then why would Allstate have paid $100,000 in damages to Mr. Marquez after the accident?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I don't know why they did that. They apparently accepted his claim on face value. People settle cases for lots of reasons. Insurance companies are averse to risk. They see a large amount of medical expenses. They have to protect their insured in a third-party context from an excess verdict, excess exposure, and so they made a decision to settle. We don't know. We can speculate as to that, but American Family certain was not binding, bound by that determination by some other carrier, nor was the jury.
But to follow up on Judge Berger's question, if Allstate did pay $100,000, wouldn't that indicate that Mr. Marquez did suffer some amount of damages?
It would indicate that Allstate decided to settle the case. I don't know how we could say that that would be proof or any kind of evidence that would support a verdict against American Family.
How
or
would
even,
you
it's a settlement.
How would you distinguish the Larson case?
The Larson case, in that case, the if you look at what the attorney said and stipulated to and said in the closing argument, opening and closing argument in that case, the lawyer told the jury that the plaintiff in that case was entitled to compensatory damages for certain items and agreed in that respect. When I gave the opening and closing argument in this case, that did not happen, because our theory of the case was that American Family had attempted to negotiate a settlement of this claim and avoid litigation, that then during the when they were sued during the discovery process, much more evidence came to light that indicated that their position that the case should be settled was probably a very generous one, and that now it was up to the jury to determine whether the insured sustained any damages. And
did you argue to the jury that there were no damages, or did you argue to the jury that the damages were less than $100,000?
I argued to the jury that it was up to them to determine whether there were damages that exceeded, that there were damages, and whether they exceeded $100,000. And then I pointed out to the jury that it appears to us that there were a lot of questions about whether this insured was injured at all in this car accident because of his credibility issues, because of his actions and statements. For instance, telling the making a claim to the insurance company that he injured his arm and his elbow and his knee, which was later found out to be all pre-existing conditions and were then admitted to by the plaintiff. So that was how we argued that. I did not take a position. I did not tell the jury to award one thing or another. I said it was up to them, and that they had much more evidence than the insurance company did when they were making their evaluation for purposes of trying to settle the case instead of litigating it, and so that it would be up to them.
Ms. Sutton, speaking of settling the case, what is your response to Mr. Levy's argument about the applicability of the Fisher case?
The Fisher case, I don't think helps the plaintiff here. In this case, the plaintiff did not make a claim that American Family owed particular portion of an underinsured motorist claim, such as medical expenses, as that occurred in Fisher, where the jury was instructed in Fisher that they could determine that State Farm unreasonably delayed or denied payment of benefits to Fisher to cover his medical expenses. In our case, medical expenses were all covered under the underlying settlement anyway. And the plaintiff did not make that argument here. The plaintiff did not tender such a jury instruction here, seeking to have the jury determine that there was some portion of his medical expenses that he was entitled to under the uninsured motorist portion of the claim, and that asking the jury to make that determination that they were unreasonably delayed or denied. So, and the Fisher case does illustrate the sort of difference between situation where an insurance company makes an offer to settle a claim to avoid the risk of litigation, and which was what was going on in this case, compared to where the insurance company has said, okay, this person has a certain amount of medical expenses that have not been paid, that are outstanding, that we know that are covered, we have no dispute about, and that we're going to pay. None of that kind of evidence came about in this case, nor was the jury asked to make that.
When American Family was made aware of the fact that it had $502 received, it should have been entitled, put in pay to the plaintiff at that stage, what is their basis for withholding that, and how does that not translate into a situation like that in Fisher?
The American Family, as of December of 2010, had paid $5,000 in medical expenses and generated explanations of benefits to those. What happened was, and the testimony of the trial was, that one of the doctors did not cash a check, and that came to light. And the Christina Osborne testified that she called the doctor's office. He told her that he wasn't seeking recovery from American Family for that $502, that the plaintiff's attorney had already paid it. Then the plaintiff's attorney put that medical expense on his list of damages he was seeking to recover on in his demand for underinsured motorist. So they knew who paid it. They wrote the check for it, apparently in the process of settling the underlying case. And then Ms. Osborne included that $502 back again on her side of the ledger for underinsured motorist. So we're just talking about, are they paying it under med expense or underinsured motorist? She accounted for that money.
But
and the lawyer accounted for it as well.
But they didn't pay it. When you say accounted, they still kept the money. They didn't pay over the money.
They did pay it over. The doctor on the other end just chose not to cash the check. And under the medical expense coverage under 10.4635, that's who they pay. They pay the provider of benefits for medical expenses incurred from the car accident. So that's what they did. The fact that he chose not to cash the check was not something that American Family took an affirmative act on.
But didn't the record show that the reason the provider didn't cash the check was because the plaintiff's counsel had paid that already? And wouldn't that mean that American Family should then reimburse whoever paid the amount with that money rather than just keep it in their bank account?
And the evidence at trial was that's what she proposed to do in her settlement offer. She included that $502 in the damages she was calculating to come up with her offer to settle the underinsured motorist case.
But so, including it in a settlement offer is a little bit different than just paying money that you owe.
Right. And the other portion of that equation is that the lawyer never requested reimbursement for that. So,
can I ask you a related question? Because in denying I think it was a post-trial motion, the trial judge addressing this $502 amount, the trial judge ruled that the jury evidently believed the testimony of Ms. Osborne that she acted reasonably under all the circumstances. But isn't that completely irrelevant as to whether a breach of contract occurred?
Well, so there was no breach of contract for medical expense benefits that was pled in this case. It wasn't in the complaint. It wasn't, there was never a motion to amend the complaint, not even at trial when they moved to amend for punitives. It's not in the TMO. It's not in an itemization of damages. This was a red herring that sort of came up trial, and it was used to support the claim of common law bad faith, that there was unreasonable conduct. And so Mr. Levy moved for, asked the court to find, to rule in their favor that this $502 that he claimed was undisclosed to plaintiff's counsel and concealed was unreasonable conduct. And the court refused to direct a verdict on that issue in his favor, finding that the jury, there was a question of fact on that issue as to whether that would constitute unreasonable conduct. It was not, there was never a claim before this jury for breach of contract for MedPay benefits. The plaintiff never tendered a jury instruction on that. He never had a complaint for that. It was not in the TMO. It was not tried by consent. It was, that evidence was on the issue of common law bad faith as opposed to a specific contract claim. The jury was adequately instructed on all claims, and looking at the instructions as a whole, looking at the evidence as a whole, the jury's verdict is certainly supported and consistent with the evidence. There was no trying of this claim by implied consent, as in the Sorcerer case. I think my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Sutton.
Thank you, Your Honors. First thing I would like to do is just address this MedPay issue very quickly. It is in our trial management order at the record, page 750, where we have specifically alleged that defendants failed to actually pay benefits that they claimed to have paid and failed to inform plaintiff that unpaid benefits remained. So that was in the trial management order, wasn't objected to by opposing counsel. At page 635 of the transcript, we were talking about the refund situation, and the claims agent, Ms. Osborne, indicated, admitted that she never told Mr. Dybul or Mr. Marquez about the refund situation. And at page 636, okay, do you concede now that this is money that is owed to Mr. Marquez? The answer is yes. That is a binding admission, unequivocal. I honestly would just say it's unreasonable as a matter of law for American Family to have taken this money, not told anybody about the money until after litigation, and then all the way through the litigation, not ever agree to pay it back. One of their excuses was that the MedPay only lasts for 1 year. You only have a time limit of 1 year, and when the refund happened, all that, the year had passed, therefore we don't owe anything else. So they were successful in this concealment, which is a violation of the Unfair Claims Practices Act, but certainly doesn't comport with due process or fairness or justice, which is why we are all here. So back to the court's order, talking about that there was evidence that the plaintiff suffered no damages as a result of the conduct of American Family. And again, that was not the standard. It had to do with damages caused by the negligent uninsured motorist. And then bringing back into the Fisher case and talking about it, one thing I want to do is disabuse a myth that is persisted in the defendant's briefing, and that is that there was some settlement offer. Now, I know Sunahara talks about that. There are cases talking about the insurance companies allowed to make settlement offers. What is missing in this analysis is a single factual support that what American Family did was considered this to be some sort of debatable or some sort of disputed settlement offer. In fact, What we have instead is we have the testimony again at page 685. We know that Mr. Marquez was injured. It was caused by an uninsured motorist. The American family had determined he was legally entitled to compensatory damages somewhere between the range of $121,000 and $131,000. Correct. That was an admission of the damages, which then takes me back to the Fisher case, where a panel of this court said, we also reject State Farm's contention that no benefits are owed until either of the parties reach an agreement with respect to the amount of the claimant's damages. And she has met her burden of proof in the appropriate judicial setting as to that amount. Because I asked Ms. Osborne at trial, why didn't you pay him something since you knew he was injured? And she said, and this is at page 848 of the transcript, again, I think it's false squarely within the Fisher. So what right do you have to say to Mr. Marquez that we're not going to pay anything unless you agree to drop your $100,000 demand? She said, well, we hadn't come to an agreement. What we felt was the value of the claim. Nothing about it being a settlement. And I also want to cite the Peterson versus Tatalini case, 97P3359, 2004. Here the jury found the plaintiff suffered actual damages related to reasonable necessary medical treatment. And this finding is inconsistent with the jury's award of zero economic damages.
Mr. Again, Levy, excuse me, your time is up. You're welcome to finish your sentence if you'd like.
Just like Larson. Thank you very much, Your
Honor. Thank you again, Mr. Levy and Ms. Sutton. We appreciate your very helpful arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. When